This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by the Georgia Radio Reading Service, GARS. Hello, I am Melanie Guralnick, and I'll be reading from the March 2025 Vanity Fair magazine. This article is called Vibe Check by James Pogue. With 2024 in the rear view, high-ranking Democrats are finally arriving at the hard truth that their party is unwell. Disarray doesn't quite cover it. As for what they're doing about it, and whether they can ever wrest the country back from Trump and Trumpism, it depends on whom you ask. It was the hottest ticket in Chicago, designed to spawn 1,000 pieces about what the party meant. 2,000 people RSVP'd. I am not kidding when I say, this is the best political party I've ever been to, the anti-gun youth activist David Hogg told a reporter. This is where Gen Z is. He was speaking at the Hotties for Harris event, held at a polished warehouse space midway through the Democratic National Convention last August. When I got there around midnight, a giant screen displayed floating images of Tim Walz's head and hundreds of free condoms reading, Fuck Project 2025, were scattered and discarded all over the floor. At least a couple hundred people were still dancing. Every third person was wearing one of those ubiquitous camouflage Harris Walz caps that had become an unlikely fashion item for Brown and Oberlin graduates working to elect a ticket that pundits and consultants seemed to believe might capture a serious slice of votes from America's hunting and fishing dads. Democratic Party girls, as Claudia Conway, the 19-year-old daughter of George and Kellyanne Conway, described herself, and TikTokers with millions of followers like Maddie Westbrock, had been invited by the score. Off to the back was a little purpose-built room with a display of free birth control, a, quote, wall of weirdos displaying photos of Republican officials, and a wall of so-called hotties who supported Harris, like Beto O'Rourke, Jason Kelsey, and Elizabeth Warren, their portraits all framed and washed from overhead in the lime-green rat hue that seemed, at least for a little bit, like it might soon ride a wave of good feelings all the way to the Oval Office. Florida Representative Maxwell Frost, the youngest member of Congress, was standing quietly by the bar. He looked like he had partied himself out for the night. He replied monosyllabically as a couple of reporters tried to engage him. I turned and began speaking to a young woman who worked for a branding consultancy called Proper Daily, which had helped put the party on. She told me they'd been doing events like it around the country. We went to bars, gave out a lot of free ice cream, a lot of free Plan B, she said. She used the phrase content-driven strategy twice. We represent brands, celebrities, and foundations, she said. There were a lot of creators coming to the DNC who didn't have much to do, so we decided we'd throw a party. I excused myself to go to the restroom and catch some fresh air. The security guard stood watch inside the men's room. I watched him block someone from going into a stall and caught his eye to inquire whether he was there to prevent people from going in to snort stimulants. He raised his eyebrows and gave as much of an answer as he could possibly have been allowed to give. What do you think? I stepped outside, hoping to bum a cigarette, and noticed that there wasn't a single person who'd come out for a smoke. These days, it would have been much more surprising to find a party full of young Republicans where no one was out smoking, or with a chaperone in the bathroom to make sure nobody did drugs. Democrats had started looking, if not to themselves, then at least to much of the country, like our National Party of Rule Followers and Honor Students. Republicans had begun to gleefully lean into the idea of their party as the home of outsiders, party boys turned cabinet picks, and, as the wall put it, weirdos. This shift had been more apparent online than in real life. But as Democrats had coalesced around a single-minded fixation, as a Democratic member of Congress put it to me later, on Donald Trump and defending against the ethical threat they believe he poses, the party had found itself in a trap. Democrats had brought together everyone from leftists to neoconservatives, a, quote, Sanders-Harris-Cheney coalition, as the Washington Post reporter Jeff Stein put it, in a popular front to defend democracy. But in an era where nearly 60% of Americans believed our democracy needed major changes, It looked to many voters like this coalition represented a well-off and well-educated establishment interested in preserving a status quo many regular Americans had come to despise. For the first time in modern history, the party would end up winning a majority of affluent voters and losing a majority of voters making less than $50,000 a year. Democrats, by dint of standing in opposition to a populist insurgency, had started to morph into what looked like America's establishment. For decades, Democrats contested national elections less by uniting voters around a shared political vision than by functioning as a coalition of regional and ethnic voting blocs thrown together in opposition to the interests of generally white, generally Protestant, asset-holding, comfortably bourgeois voters who tended to reside in the leafier precincts of the Northeast and Upper Midwest. The idea of the Democratic Party as the home of outsiders set against this proper establishment goes back to days long before left and right were meaningful dividing lines in American politics. It is in some ways the fundamental feature of the party's DNA. In contemporary history, even as a bipartisan, quote, establishment consensus came to shape both the style and substance of American politics, it tended to be Republicans who openly aligned with Chamber of Commerce types, our federal spy and security agencies, and our military commitments abroad. Now, Republicans of this stripe, from Liz Cheney to former Congressman Adam Kinzinger to former George W. Bush speechwriter David Frum, were loudly supporting the Harris-Walz ticket. The Democrats would soon face 4 years of playing rearguard defense for all those institutions of state and long-held political norms that Republicans have been cheerfully set to attack. I left and walked back toward Lake Michigan. I ended up at a Greek after-hours bar, where a trio of drunken young Harris campaign staffers offered me a shot of Fernet Branca. "What we mean when we call them weird," one very large young man, sweating in a black suit, told me, "is that they're fucking irresponsible people. Put that down. It's actually cool to be a responsible steward of a fucking democracy." Two young women in floral print dresses gave a small cheer. That week, all the public talk at the convention was about joy, energy, and vibes. Few seemed aware that half the country was sensing the same energy pointing in the opposite direction. "This is where real political power lies," Hogg had said back at the party. "It's not in politics. It's actually in culture, because when culture changes, politics change." The joy, energy, and unity are all now the stuff of sardonic jokes. The unity was obvious and real, but the energy was far more palpable on cable news than in the United Center, where the Chicago Bulls play their home games. Reporters complained constantly of being bored and spent long days slouched up in the cheap seats, trading tips on which senators might have availability in the afternoon or where the good parties were. "It hasn't exactly been what I hoped," a local volunteer wearing a big Teachers for Kamala button told me as we rode the L to the arena together. They wanted to be a really sustainable event, so a big group of us has been on a duty to sort out compost from the trash. But I don't think I've missed much yet. And the joy manifested itself mostly as a relief that President Joe Biden had dropped out and Democrats now had a fighting chance. The big-name speaker summoned a stern sense of mission. Barack Obama admonished the crowd that, quote, "this is still going to be a tight race." Bernie Sanders came out to the old chants of "Bernie, Bernie." The whole arena swelled, and the bitter animosities and fanatic energies of 2016 and 2020 seemed like very old history. Sanders gave a speech arguing that Biden, by leveraging the power of government toward a national industrial policy, anti-monopoly efforts, infrastructure, and climate, had been a more transformative president than many understood. Behind the scenes, Democrats argued several times to me that Biden actually represented our first, quote, post-neoliberal president, a figure who had marked a break with the trend toward financialization, globalization, and prioritization of markets and business interests above almost any other national interest that had shaped policymaking in both parties in the decades before 2016. I later dug up a short piece I remembered from this time, titled, "The Decorous Demise of the Establishment, which traced the end of the, quote, establishment consensus sometime around when Jeb Bush was forced out of the race for president. It is hard to imagine future generations of candidates returning to the same establishment style embodied by Mitt Romney and Jeb Bush, Mark Leibovich wrote in the New York Times Magazine, or going back to the same well of on-message orthodoxy. They won't spend tens of millions on ads, enriching the same cast of consultants and operatives. But by 2024, Democrats had gone back to exactly this well of orthodoxy and even the same set of trusted campaign pros, like David Plouffe, to preach it. Can you run just an incredibly intensive presidential campaign as if you were running a dead heat battleground state governor's campaign? He asked before the election. And I think we can. The great looming risk of a second Trump presidency had made party leaders visibly averse to risks of any other kind. Toward the end of his speech, Sanders raised a finger and wagged it in that faux hectoring way of his. "Let us be very clear," he said. "This is not a radical agenda." A couple of older women near me cheered, and a tentative swell of applause rose up in the arena before people seemed to realize this wasn't supposed to be an applause line. "Let me tell you what a radical agenda is," he said. "Trump's Project 2025. On the second night of the convention, I stopped at a small gathering at a lakeside franchise of Harry Curry's Steakhouse. I was looking to talk to Jamie Raskin. In the past few years, the Maryland congressman has taken roles on the House Special Committee investigating the January 6th riot, and as the lead impeachment manager charged with prosecuting Trump for insurrection in his trial before the Senate. He has emerged, at least in the liberal media sphere, as a symbolic leader of the effort to defend America's institutional stability and constitutional order. Raskin was swarmed by a crowd of fans and hangers-on inside the bar, so I had a beer outside, chatting with a woman from Orange County, California, who owned a company that did something in the field of, quote, biotherapeutics. She caught the eye of Michael Cohen, the former Trump fixer turned inmate turned cable news bit player, who was hovering around, eagerly posing for selfies with everyone who approached him. "You're so brave," one woman said, wearing a number of chunky beaded necklaces. "I'm not brave," he said. "I just love my country." Cohen's demeanor changed when I told him I was a writer. "Call Maggie Haberman," he said, "or call, do you know Cuomo?" "All of them. They all have my number. Everyone calls me." A young guy in a white Oxford shirt was very interested to talk about a gap in energy and political vision between Democrats and Republicans. He said he had recently left a state-level position to take a job on the Harris campaign staff. "Democrats really just don't want to see there's a crisis," he said. "A lot of us, at least." I asked if he wanted to sit down and talk for a while, but he hurriedly shook his head. "Take my card," he said. "Let's stay in touch." "But I can't," he looked around. "You get it, I can't talk here." I was finding, much to my surprise, that Democrats at this convention were harder to convince to speak freely than Republicans, who may hate the media and regard us as an intelligence-gathering arm working for an enemy power structure, but they're rarely boring. I explained to him I was looking to speak with Raskin to talk over this problem Democrats faced in suddenly looking like the party defending the status quo and institutions of state. I think this is really the core conversation in America politics right now, the Harris staffer texted me later. I completely agree about how head-spinning it is to see the American right begin to own anti-blob arguments that used to be the provenance of the left. The blob is a term coined by Ben Rhodes, a former senior advisor to Obama, to describe the intractable nest of private and governmental interests that make up our national security establishment. Not so long ago, a thing Republicans rarely criticized. The staffer marveled at how prevalent this conversation is becoming in circles where it previously seemed kind of unthinkable. There was no way to get Raskin alone at the party, where the crowd of admirers had not thinned at all in the time I'd been outside. So we met around 4 the next afternoon and traveled in a small entourage, very slowly, past the concession stands and roped off sections reserved for streaming influencers, stopping every 10 yards or so as another nervous pair of fans would approach to wish him well, thank him, and tentatively asked to shake his hand and snap a picture. We took a tightly guarded elevator up to a suite on the 8th floor in the rarefied VIP area housing skyboxes and executive suites. The actor, Mandy Patinkin, was in the hallway as we exited the elevator. He froze when he saw Raskin. He clasped his hand and held on to it as they talked. "I just want to thank you so much for everything you did on the committee," Patinkin said, "to put Trump away, hold him accountable for his insurrection." "I appreciate that," Raskin said. "I just want to know if there's anything I could do to help," Patinkin said. "Well, now you know you've got friends in low places on Capitol Hill," Raskin said. "Thank you." I waited for a while as Raskin did a spot with a trim 35-year-old streamer in a tight-fitting suit named Brian Tyler Cohen. I had never heard of him before, but he has 3.5 million followers on YouTube, and he'd just gotten word that his new book, called Shameless, Republicans' Deliberate Dysfunction and the Battle to Preserve Democracy, had reached the top of the New York Times bestseller list. Raskin congratulated him, and the two did a friendly interview about how Trump had, quote, met his match with Harris. "You served on the January 6th committee," Cohen said. "As Donald Trump becomes more and more unhinged and desperate, it elevates the possibility of violence or danger in the same way that we saw the insurrection on January 6, 2021. Does that worry you at all, the prospect of another insurrection?" "We have improved the physical defense of the Capitol against MAGA, insurrectionists, and so on," Raskin said. "We're ready for them." We sat in a pair of armchairs overlooking the floor as the New York Congressman Tom Suozzi spoke far below us. Raskin wore a formal gray suit with an incongruous pair of chunky white-soled sneakers, the same kind that left the New York Times-style writer Guy Trebay despondent over the state of our establishment when Mitch McConnell, Hakeem Jeffries, and Kevin McCarthy turned up wearing them in an Oval Office meeting in 2023. Raskin, 62, is small in build, with a bit of a comb-over, but he conveys a gravity and command that must serve well in the setting of a televised congressional hearing. I explained I thought Trump had a good chance of winning, and that if he did, Raskin might soon be at the center of some very bitter battles. Steve Bannon had predicted that a second Trump administration would hit the Department of Justice with a blowtorch. "Well, they assert a very strong version of the unitary executive theory," he said. "It will be Donald Trump calling up the Attorney General and ordering him to do whatever Trump wants in terms of squashing investigation of someone who has given him the big campaign contribution or going after a perceived political enemy. That's a radical reversal of our understanding of the relationship between the president and the prosecutorial function. They're putting that at the center." Raskin was elected in 2016 with the help of the Sanders-aligned PACs, and in his early years in Congress, he developed a reputation as a civil libertarian and skeptic of the so-called blob. But the Trump years and January 6 seemed to make him more sympathetic toward our internal security apparatus. Last April, Raskin reversed a position he'd taken on two procedural votes and ended up casting what amounted to the decisive vote to preserve the, quote, backdoor search loophole in the Foreign Service Intelligence Act, which allows federal agencies like the FBI and the National Security Agency to surveil the communications of American citizens in some circumstances without probable cause or a warrant, a power that has been used since the Bush administration to spy on dozens of, quote, racial justice protesters, a state judge, a professor, a sitting congressman, and a U.S. senator, and even a batch of 19,000 unsuspecting donors to a congressional campaign, according to a report from the Brennan Center for Justice. He understood where I was going. "Let me first start with the domestic analogies of what you're saying," he said. "In the Judiciary Committee, I spent many years sitting there while Jim Jordan and Matt Gaetz and all the right-wingers attacked the FBI. And they're attacking the FBI for one very simple reason, which is they were investigating Donald Trump." Raskin might have talked about his father at this moment. Marcus Raskin was a lefty policymaker and anti-war activist who was prosecuted but not convicted for aiding draft dodgers, and he was one of the first to receive documents that were eventually published as the Pentagon Papers. In 1976, two of Marcus's colleagues at the think tank he co-founded were murdered by a car bomb that agents of the U.S.-backed government of Augusto Pinochet had planted on the D.C. streets. Now, as someone who is perfectly aware of the COINTELPRO program, which is spelled COINTELPRO, and the FBI surveillance and sabotage against the civil rights movement, I believe that the FBI should not be used as an instrument of political aggression, Raskin said to me now. So, I was in the awkward position of having to defend the law enforcement objectivity of the FBI in terms of the Trump investigations. As far as we know, it had been operating in a completely objective law enforcement fashion, he said. So, in the international context, we'd say the CIA was clearly involved and complicit in Pinochet's overthrow of the Allende government in Chile in 1973. That doesn't mean that the CIA is attacking Donald Trump. He resisted the idea that Democrats had become the party of the status quo. To the extent that we are going to derive a grand political philosophy, a new public philosophy, he said, will be one that emerges from the very specific programmatic answers we come up with to deal with real-world crises, including climate change, including economic inequality, and including the kind of social polarization which is being promoted by the right wing. It's consistent with the tradition of American pragmatism, he said, arguing for a liberalism that could bring a revolution by increments. And pragmatism gets a bad name because people think pragmatism means just adjusting to political reality. That is not what it means. He referred back to John Dewey and William James, who had proffered pragmatism as America's natural political philosophy. It's the use of social experimentation to address widely felt social problems, he said. That's where the Tennessee Valley Authority comes from. That's where the National Park Service comes from. A staffer gave us notice that we had to vacate the suite. I did want to ask you, she said to Raskin. There is an influencer next door doing special coverage. They said they have 5 million followers. They'd love to talk to you. Can we take 3 more minutes? Raskin asked her. In Democratic circles, talk about politics often stays within such a narrow band of issues and horse race chatter that officials at the DNC often seemed intrigued to talk big picture. Raskin and I talked about how Biden would be remembered and about the coming election, which he seemed confident Harris would win. He had written a letter to Biden 2 weeks before he dropped out, and it eventually ended up being published in the New York Times. I said that he would retire to the overwhelming love and appreciation of the country, he told me, and it would usher in an extraordinary cathartic outpouring of progressive energy in the country. I believe those things, and I think it has begun to come true. He looked out toward the floor. It's like a dam breaking in terms of progressive, youthful energy for the future. That night, I went to a party hosted by Dropsite News, started recently by the left-wing reporter Ryan Grimm. I ended up vaping outside with a big donor to both the site and to the Democratic Party, a dapper and erudite man who'd been a construction worker before he made a bunch of money in finance, who is now looking for ways to push the party toward a more populist and anti-establishment worldview. We talked about a passage from Norman Mailer's dispatch from the 1964 Republican National Convention, held at the Cow Palace in San Francisco. Mailer had written it as a picture of a moment when a wild new energy of conservatives in the West and the Sun Belt formed behind the candidacy of Barry Goldwater and caught the old, quote, establishment of the East, as Mailer called it, with its heartland stretching from Maine to Nassau, New York to south of France, off guard. This establishment had waited too long to find a moderately liberal candidate who bore its pedigree. It took half a century and the emergence of Trump to finally complete the rebellion Goldwater had begun. Mailer wrote of hearing a band of bagpipers marching constantly through the streets that week. There was a vast, if all private appeal in listening to the pipes shrill out the herald of a new crusade, he said. Something jagged, Viking, hunters loose in the land again. And this had an appeal which burrowed deep. There was excitement at the thought of Goldwater getting the nomination. Against the piper's tribal skirl, the left's answer had long been the promise of a utopian future built out of collective struggle. Their welling energies were summoned by songs like Solidarity Forever, We Shall Overcome, and Which Side Are You On?, the miners' protest song written by a 12-year-old miner's daughter named Florence Reese. A hint of this old energy came on the first day of the convention from the United Automobile Workers president, Sean Fain. He played on the fact that J.D. Vance's family came from the coal fields in eastern Kentucky and accused Vance of abandoning his roots to align with billionaires like Elon Musk. Which side are you on? He asked. But big-name Democrats and the consultant class these days often seem so professional, so competent, so well-trained that this kind of energy no longer fits into their calculations about how to win narrow elections. After the election, I saw clips of a moving speech given by Cecil Roberts, Jr., the West Virginia-born president of the United Mine Workers of America. He spoke to the, quote, blood that flows through our body as a generational memory of a multiracial and often violent struggle that now lingered as little more than a historical trivia curiosity to the technocrat-minded liberals who'd promised a, quote, just transition for laborers in, quote, fading industries like coal mining. He cast a pox on the house of everyone in power. When you hear some rich person, he said, some CEO, some chairman of the board, talk about the patriotism of their company or the patriotism of their board, understand something. Forgive me for what I'm about to say, but that's pure bullshit. That's what that is. Roberts knew full well that, at least in private, most senior Democrats saw him and his members as people who cling, in the infamous phrase Obama had used, to a lost world. But he argued that our economy is still, as much as ever, built on manufacturing and resource extraction, from lumber logged in Canada to industrial goods made in Chinese factories that are, in turn, powered by coal-fired energy. Democrats have needed a wake-up call now for some time, he said. And if there's anything good that came out of this, I hope that they listen. At one time, everybody listened to me. Union members voted for the vice president, he said, based on what we've seen from the polls. But working people didn't do that. He thought the age of Democrats being able to present themselves as the party of the working class was likely over. I'm a Democrat, he said. I'm going to die one because I've been one forever. But here's the problem. What about the next generation and the next generation? That's all the time we have for this story, which is called Vibe Check by James Pogue. That concludes today's reading from Vanity Fair Magazine, March 2025. This has been Melanie Guralnick for the Georgia Radio Reading Service. Thank you for listening to GARS.